Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 118 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Mathematically speaking, the shortest distance between point A and point B is a straight line, but history pretty much never works that way, and that's what makes it fascinating. A big driver of some of the most interesting historical research is the question, how did we get here? And spoiler alert, it's not ancient aliens. Tracing the steps of the people of the past can be a tricky and painstaking business, especially in times and places when there isn't a lot of written evidence left behind. When it comes to English history, the roots of some important traditions and political institutions began in one of those pockets of huge change but scarce written material in the centuries after the Romans left and the Normans arrived, making it challenging to find answers. Enter Dr. Mark Morris. Mark Morris is the best-selling author of several books, including The Norman Conquest, King John, and Castles, as well as one of my personal favorites, A Great and Terrible King, Edward I and the Forging of Britain. He's known not only for his accessible and informative writing style, but also for being probably the only medieval historian to ever get a shout-out from Scarlett Johansson. This year, Mark brings his meticulous scholarship and his pithy wit to an even earlier time period with his new book, The Anglo-Saxons, A History of the Beginnings of England, 400 to 1066. Here's our conversation on the challenges of writing about a time with fewer written sources, balancing the narrative in a cast of thousands, and some of the most interesting and influential figures in English history. Well, thank you, Mark, for joining me to talk about your new book. It's so great to have you on the podcast.
It's very kind of you to have invited me.
Oh, well, I've always wanted to meet you. This is just an excuse. So before we get into the history, though, we do need to address the terminology. I think that there are a lot of people who follow medieval studies, but they don't necessarily know that there is a discussion right now about actually dropping the term Anglo-Saxon for numerous reasons. And as I understand it, the main reason is that it tends to be conflated with race. So when people talk about Anglo-Saxon, they're not necessarily talking about culture, they're talking about race. And that means whiteness. And then of course that gets appropriated into these discussions of whiteness and supremacy and things like that. And historically over the last century or so, Anglo-Saxon has been used in a way that is meant to promote racial superiority, especially in the early 20th century, as I understand it. So of course we have to be sensitive to something that gets weaponized by people. You've chosen to keep using this term. So what are your reasons for holding on to the term?
Well, as I said, I think I say at the start of the book, I think it's unavoidable. I totally understand the reasons why people would wish to drop it. And as you sort of said in your own question, it varies over time. You know, it was used particularly in the early 20th century. And it's particularly in North America as opposed to the UK itself. I mean, my main reason is I think it's unavoidable. It's been in use to describe, you know, the people living in what becomes England between the 5th and the 11th centuries since the late 16th century. And, you know, it continues to be used in that sense today, especially in the UK, where more than 9 times out of 10 when it's used to describe the people living in England during that period. And I think when you're using words, I mean, it depends on context, the way they're understood. If someone says to me, I enjoy a full English breakfast, I don't think, oh, goodness me, you know, that's no alarm bell goes off in my head. Whereas if someone says to me, I think England should be for the English, then you kind of go, oh, okay. And then you realize they're using that in a much more loaded sense with a particular kind of ethnic agenda. And I think the same is true with phrases like Anglo-Saxons. I think if someone says, you know, I'm very keen on my Anglo-Saxon heritage and culture, then you kind of go, well, you know, you can drill down into that and say, well, what do you mean by that, for goodness sake? You know, you're using a term that's used to describe people who've kind of haven't been in any sense in any power since the 11th century. Whereas if people say Alfred was king of the Anglo-Saxons, then it is, I think, a perfectly straightforward to construe their meaning. So, as I say, I think that the main problem is that when it's in such broad use, then it becomes unavoidable. And I think if you try to avoid it, I mean, of course, you can avoid anything if you're determined, but you end up speaking in circumlocutions. I mean, these people called themselves Angles and they called themselves Saxons. And eventually, but quite late in the day, maybe as late as the 10th century, angle starts to win out as the favoured term when kings in the 10th century, kings of Wessex start to describe themselves increasingly as kings of the English, you know, Rex Anglorum. But even in the early 10th century, you know, you've got people describing everyone living in what was becoming England as Saxons, the Saxon people. So I think it's a term that's used by kings of Wessex from Alfred onwards and kings of the English from that point onwards to describe the people they rule over, right down to 1066, then abandoned, but then revived, as I say, in the late 16th century. So for that reason, I and a great many scholars continue to use it.
Yeah, for me, this isn't a period that I spend a lot of time in. It's easy for me to not have to decide on that much of the time. For me, I tend to use early English when I'm talking about culture, when I'm talking about that period. I tend to use white if I'm talking about race, but these are the terms that I tend to use. And I think that this is unresolved and nobody has come up with a perfect solution for this. So what I think it's important just to remind people who are listening is to be sensitive to our words and the impact they might have and pay attention to the context, as you say, Mark. And I think that both of us can agree that the place I want to leave it is both of us can agree that however we use our terminology, it's never an excuse to abuse our colleagues, especially our colleagues of color, and especially online. So let's leave it there as something that is unresolved. But I appreciate that you have taken the time to speak with me about that, because it is an important debate, I think, that's going on right now. All right, so let's jump into the work. Mm-hmm. So I've been reading your work since A Great and Terrible King, which was written about Edward I. And then as I've seen your career go, it's moving further back in time. So you're talking about King Edward, you talk about King John in another book, and then you talked about the Norman Conquest, which is another great book. And now here you are talking about the time before the Norman Conquest. So what is pulling you backwards?
Well,
in history?
I think I have to disagree there, because I've actually jumped around. It sound like it was a well thought out plan. anyone who knows me, my career is not a well thought out plan. This is what kind of like this is me leading up to my career as a guitarist. This is my temporary job. I started off with The Great and Terrible King because I'd done 13th century history for my thesis, and I'd done the Earls of Norfolk for my thesis. And a lot of the focus of that was in the late 13th century, which is the reign of Edward I. So he seemed to me to be a good topic, who I felt there was a good book waiting to be written about him. And then I did the Norman Conquest. And again, it's simply whenever I try to come up with the idea for a book, it's normally looking at my bookshelves and staring at them for weeks on end and thinking, well, because I live by my pen, it has to be relatively broad topic. I can't sort of say it's about the, you know, a vicar who lives in Suffolk and does not much at all. It has to have some ballast to it. I kind of felt that there hadn't been a big book on the Norman Conquest for about 50 years when I came to do that book. I mean, there are lots of tiny books on the Norman Conquest, because academics tend, I think, to do big books on their particular part of the garden that they cultivate. So they'll talk about the aristocracy of East Anglia in the 11th century or the 13th century, as I did. But when it comes to doing a bigger topic, they're often commissioned to write short introductory texts for their students or the general public. So there'll be 150 or 200 pages, not enough to treat in full a subject like the Conquest. So I went to the Conquest, then I did King John, because I'd been talking about doing King John since the start of my career. My publishers had wanted me to do King John 10 years earlier. That coincided with the anniversary of Magna Carta. And then I kind of felt I'd exhausted the post-conquest period, or rather the immediately post-conquest period. And I was either going to have to go later or earlier. And I sort of chose to go earlier. So there's no sense for planning.
No, that's absolutely fair. I don't think anybody's career ever goes the way they planned it. And that's a good thing, actually. But talking about the centuries before the Norman Conquest is a completely different thing in terms of sources as a historian from the 14th century, where there are a whole lot of sources. So how did you approach talking about a time where there are a lot fewer sources?
Yeah, I mean, the source material for this period, as you say, it's thin, particularly at the beginning of the period. And it gave me a kind of much deeper respect for people who specialize in studying these centuries. Because I'd done the Conquest and I'd done late Anglo-Saxon England as a postgraduate, I knew the 10th and the 11th centuries reasonably well. And I contemplated just doing a book that covered those centuries, but it just felt like laziness. I kind of felt, if you're going to do this, go back to the beginning, go back to the end of Roman Britain. So that was kind of terra incognita for me. I had the sort of, I think, the sense of, well, we must know something about King Offer because he ruled for nearly 40 years. And then when you kind of actually look at the evidence, you go, oh, really? Nothing at all. No narrative sources, just kind of coins and charters and, you know, bits remembered, kind of the old remembered date in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle or the, you know, the Welsh Annals or something, but nothing really meaty to get your teeth into. So it does pose the problem of how you are going to navigate across the centuries and marshal this evidence in a way that people can make sense of. Because my experience and my impression was that general books on this period bubbled with enthusiasm and love for the subject, but could read a bit like a kind of, just like a sort of loose assemblage of passions, you know. So like someone sort of you'd encounter in a pub or something, and they'd say, I'll tell you another thing about the Anglo-Saxons, which is brilliant. And you go, oh, that's fascinating. And they say, and another thing that's brilliant is this. And you go, yeah, that's brilliant. And then they just went one more thing, one more thing. And everything needed to be arranged in a kind of way that you built from nothing. And everything unfolded in a narrative way where there was no narrative. I mean, that was the tricky thing, because if you, things like, you know, say the Norman Conquest or even later King John, you'll know from your experience as a 14th century historian that there are certain bits of source material that when you stumble across them or when you read them, you think, well, that's going in the book. Or even better, you will read them and you think, my work here is done. This will write itself. You know, if you come across source material that is so rich and useful and kind of apposite to what you're doing, then you can say, I mean, I literally get to points when I'm doing rough drafts of things where I will think I'll do all the heavy lifting and the setup. And if it then ends with, like, you know, I don't know, the Battle of Evesham or something, I think we can leave that because that's straightforward. I've written enough books in the last 20 years that I know how to do a battle, you know?
Yeah.
And make it pay off and make it count. Whereas if it's, you know, you can only approach offer through coins, charters, and the occasional ecclesiastical letter, then how do you make that play? You know, so that was the challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I first got my first contract for a trade book, I was talking to Dan Jones about it. And I said, okay, what can you tell me as someone who's published this stuff before? And he said, the structure is the most important thing. The structure is what you really have to wrestle with. And so for the people who haven't read your book yet, you've structured each chapter around, usually around a figure, and then built around that. And I think it's actually masterfully done how you do that. But so you've picked a figure. So why did you pick a figure to build around for each of these things? Was it a source issue, or is it building around drama, perhaps?
Mainly it's the source thing. And it only fell into place really with chapter three, because chapter three is focused on the figure of Bishop Wilfrid, who is bishop of, well, lots of places, Northumbria in the first instance, but sort of moonlights in Sussex and moonlights in Mercia and all over the place, and has a very, very interesting, turbulent, dynamic career. He's kind of like a Thomas Becket figure, but rather than sort of, you know, getting done in after a dozen years, he goes on for decades, you know, aggravating people and inspiring other people. Fantastic source material at a time when the only other thing we've got is Bede, and thank goodness we've got Bede. But I had written a chapter on sort of the conversion of England from paganism to Christianity. And it kind of had a cast of thousands, you know, and I tried to whittle it down to the most important people. And of course, what kept happening was Wilfrid kept pulling it off balance because there's so much good material in Wilfrid's story. You kind of think, well, I've got to have this bit where he fights the pagans of Sussex on the beaches, you know. But actually, we were talking about Theodore. And then there was a kind of a light bulb moment where I almost as a sort of joke, because it was just such a messy chapter, I sort of scrawled on the top of a draft, why not make the whole damn thing about Wilfrid? And that actually solved the problem, because then you can legitimately foreground all that stuff. And you're not telling a narrow biography. You're using him as a prism in which to explore nearly a century of change, because he lives into his 70s. And also his life takes in, it takes you to all the major places you need to go. So he goes to Rome several times. So you can talk about Rome's influence on Britain. He starts on Lindisfarne. So he's the bridge between the Celtic and the Roman churches and the conflict between them. So once that chapter kind of came into focus, it seemed that that was a way to model other chapters. But other chapters were already going in that direction. For example, it's very hard to do a book on the Anglo-Saxons and not have a chapter dedicated to King Alfred. it would be quite, you know, almost perverse to say, well, I'm going to sort of soft pedal King Alfred and foreground someone else. Because again, Alfred is celebrated because of his undoubtedly stellar qualities as a ruler. His epithet great is deserved, I think, is one of the conclusions I come to in the book, that the chapter explores whether it is or not. But it's also because he has a contemporary biography. And again, to ignore that and say, well, you know, I'm not going to actually focus on this contemporary voice, Bishop Asser, telling us about this very important king. Instead, I'm going to look at, you know, the archaeology of 9th century Lincolnshire. That would be, seems to me, a willfully perverse choice. So to answer your question, it's basically guided by the source material. I was quite actually pleased with when those light bulb moments went off. I mean, the main problem with a book like this is not to have it all be kings. As I say in the start of the book, it's impossible, I think, not to have it be predominantly men, because the source material is predominantly written by men about men. There are women who feature in the book, but there is no source rich enough that enabled me to say, well, I'm going to look at this 100-year period and focus it on one particular woman. It's something that a couple of reviewers have commented on and said, well, he could have foregrounded this woman or that woman, as if I was kind of consciously sort of made a decision to say, well, the fewer women, the better. It always irks me when people say, with other books as well, like Edward I, I would have liked to know more about his children or his wife. And it's like, oh, would you? You know, it's as if I just kind of neglected a contemporary biography of his eldest son or something, or his queen. It's like, we'd all like to know more about it. The question is there any evidence? And if you want more rampant speculation about his sex life or you know, what his queen wore, then historical fiction is the way to go. But I have to deal with the evidence I have to hand. So to get back to the Anglo-Saxons for a second, the thing that seemed most important from the point of view of this book was, once you got beyond Alfred, for it not to become a serial biography of the kings of Wessex. Because that's the story they want to tell. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is about, there was this king and he did these great things, and then he died, and then there was his son and he did other great things. And it is a piece of royal propaganda that's focused on the monarchs. And actually, in spite of that, most of the kings of the 10th century, when the most exciting stuff is going on in terms of state formation, are completely nondescript. We know very little about them. And what we do know about them comes from the lives of saints. And actually, when I read the saints' lives, I thought, actually, these guys are fascinating. And these are guys who, they live forever. You know, they again, live into their 70s. I mean, Dunstan is the focus of that chapter because he's the biggest kind of reformer of them all. But his life coincides with, I think it's 8 kings of Wessex/England. And it's a life rich in detail and anecdote and incident, which you can engage people with and use as a skeleton or a series of hooks, that's a better word, to hang other points on. You know, it's as you say, it's structure, and it's giving the reader something to cling on to rather than saying, yeah, enough about him, I'm going to tell you about her. And it's just like, you know, if you had a film where it kind of started off with one character and you thought, oh, we're investing in this character, great. And then 7 minutes in, they said, oh, no, he died. You know, he's not important anymore. We're going to go somewhere else. And it's that trying to make it cohere.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's really important, having that human element, and something that actually is a recurring theme in my work in the podcast as well, as bringing that human element to the work so that you see people. And I think that that's what draws the reader in. So you have these hooks that you're hanging things on. And one of the things that you bring in, and I should mention that I appreciate the fact that you haven't put in a lot of women, but that's because you don't have the source material. And I think that's something people can expect from your work, is that if you don't have evidence, you're not going to put it in. Yeah. And I think that's valuable.
I have put in, you know, as many women as I could get into it. it's just that, I think particularly it's true of the Anglo-Saxon period, is that, and again, this is something I'm robbing from my own introduction, there are lots and lots of ways in which this period is presented as a golden age. Golden age for everybody, a golden age for the church, a golden age for women. And like a lot of, you know, golden ages, when you start to sort of actually examine the evidence, it turns out to be very, very tarnished and probably not golden at all. And in the case of women, since the late 18th century, but particularly in the 20th century, it was said that women in Anglo-Saxon England had a much better time than they did in post-conquest England. And actually, as I think it's Pauline Stafford about 25 years ago demonstrated. This is all built on sand, little bits of sand, you know, not a great bed of sand. And actually, their rights were no better prior to 1066. But also, the problem is that we just can't perceive them. And so people think, you know, why isn't there more in your book about someone like Ethelfled or Athelflad, depending on you how you pronounce it, Lady of the Mercians? You know, yeah, she sounds really important. Yes, she was very important. But the source material for her life, two versions of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, the Mercian one gives her about 8 lines and not long lines. You know, she came to Derby and took it and that and built a new burgh. That's it. And the Wessex version of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle kind of says, oh, yeah, she died. Basically only records her death. So you can't spin page after page about her without indulging in just unwarranted speculation. All you've got are a few very, very sparse sentences. To reiterate a point I've made 3 or 4 times now, it's you go where the good stuff is, the treasure, you know, the stuff that really makes the period come alive. There are countless women discussed in the book to the fullest extent that the evidence will permit.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is an important caveat there as to the extent that the evidence will permit. And one thing that I notice about the book is that when people write about this time, there's always a pull to talk about the Vikings. And that's something that you haven't done a lot in this book. And I actually think that's a good thing. You're kind of sticking with the island and the people who are living in Britain at the time. So was that a conscious choice to not talk about the Vikings, especially because they're so trendy?
The Vikings come into the story, but they don't. This isn't a book that's about, you know, 793 to 954 or something. You know, it's not a book about the Vikings. It's a book about the subtitle of the book, which is A History of the Beginnings of England. And that's the premise of the book, or that's the leitmotif of the book, such as it is. There's a country called England now. And if you go back to 1066, there was a country called England then. And it's, you know, they had lots in common. So you have an English church, which is based at Canterbury, and an English political establishment, which is based at Westminster, and a country that is divided into shires and boroughs and cities and towns and parishes, and a people who call themselves the English, and they live in a country they call England. So that's all there by the end of the 10th century. But if you go back to the 5th century, or indeed even to the 7th century, none of that's there. There's no Christianity. There are no shires. They don't think of themselves as having a common land. And all of this, therefore, is created or invented during these centuries. So that's the theme I keep sort of picking up and putting down, is where does all this come from? How do you go from, I think, a quite alien landscape? If you look at Roman Britain, it's kind of temples and forums and Latin words which are lost, you know, concepts which are lost. It's a diocese which is divided into provinces, you know, and this is all lost with the fall of Rome. Whereas, by the time you get to late Anglo-Saxon England, you're talking about boroughs and shires and sheriffs and kings and bishops and monks and monasteries, all these things that continue in most cases right down to the present day. And so resonate with people. People think, oh, I know what you mean by a sheriff, whether they're in the UK or the US, you know. Whereas if you start talking about Commes Britanniae or something, it's like, well, what's that? So that it talks about a world that's lost and a world that is still with us in some respects.
Yeah. And I think that I want to really focus on something that you've just said here, which is that people have words that they understand, they know. And one of the things that you talk about as a way of getting at this period that doesn't have a lot of sources is looking at things like the names of the towns, right? You have the burghs, you have the witch. So tell us a little bit about how looking at place names helped you in building this period for the reader.
Oh, gosh. I mean, not very much is the straightforward answer. But let's get out this question as quickly as we can. I mean, this is something that I was taught when I was at 12 years old at school. If you look at the place names, I live in the southeast of England, a county called Kent. And if you look at the place names, lots of them end in ing and lots of them end in ingham or ham or ingham. And these are relics of Old English. Place names that go back in most cases to the 6th or 7th centuries, if not the 5th century, probably not the 5th century, but places that end in ing or ingus, this means the people of. So it's, you know, someone like Reading, it's Radder's people. Or in the case of Birmingham, it's the hamlet or the settlement of Berm's people. place name studies is a discipline in itself. And so I only touch on this very briefly in the first or second chapters. It's like a lot of things in the book. You know, there are, in order to do this period justice, you have to kind of, if not become a bona fide expert on these sub-disciplines, you have to get your head around numismatics, diplomatic, place name studies, and of course, latterly, science, something I haven't done since I was a teenager, you know, DNA analysis, you know, isotopes in teeth, that kind of thing. And again, without trying to overburden the reader. And a lot of this stuff, it's kind of, you're reading quite detailed reports, whether they're archaeological or to do with coins, and you are looking for the take-home point. You know, you're reading a 30-page article and saying, that's the crux of this. This is the most persuasive part of this. If you had to get it down to a sentence, what would it be? And that's the point. So it's not often more than a sentence, but maybe a paragraph or two. Then if people share your enthusiasm and are equally convinced by your redaction of it, they can go and explore the whole thing. They can go and spend their life doing place name studies. But that you can't allow that kind of thing to derail a book. And to get back to the question you asked about the Vikings, it's the same with the Vikings. You can't, you know, just because they're kind of sexy and hairy and scary and very en vogue at the moment, you can't let them come in and take over the book. It's a book about England and their impact on England. But of course, the thing about the Vikings is if they'd written more stuff down, they'd get a bigger share of the book, you know. But if they don't write it down until the 12th or 13th centuries, by which stage they're just making it up, you know, and you can't believe a word of it, then, you know, it'd be lovely. I'd happily have a huge section on the Danelaw. But if they burn down all the libraries and the cathedrals and the monasteries, and all they're capable of doing is kind of scratching their name on a sword, then you've written yourself out of the story to some extent, haven't you?
It's their own fault.
It's their own fault, you know. So I talk about the archaeology of the Danelaw, but I'd say they get a good chunk of the story for illiterate, you know, invaders.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I think that's fair. So while we're on the topic, when you write a book, even a book that is as extensive as this one is, you have to kill your darlings. That's what they tell you. So what was it that you might have liked to put in here that you couldn't put in?
Oh, God. I mean, in draft, I think this is the thing. This is the most frustrating thing. And I always feel that I'm probably my own worst enemy here is I write very extensive timelines. So, I mean, there are timelines that go across voids in this book. So, I mean, for example, just the kings of Mercia or kings in general, they feature in the third chapter in as much as they're in part of Wilfred's story, but that's foregrounding Wilfred and the church. So the kings are just bubbling away as secondary or tertiary even characters in the background. And then the chapter on Mercia is focused on Offa and to a lesser extent his immediate predecessor, Athelbald. But I'd done a timeline and I'd done as much as I could on all Athelbald's predecessors, and because you're looking to see if convention has got it wrong. If offered, is worthy of a chapter. And sometimes with the case of the 10th century kings, I might have said, well, there's a chapter on Edgar. And it's only when you come to sort of look at Edgar and you kind of think there's nothing here. There's law codes, but there is no narrative. There's the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles got about 7 lines on Edgar, you know, or someone like King Canute. I mean, it sounds sexy because people know him because of the Henry of Huntingdon story about telling the sea not to wet his feet. Mm-hmm. But the narrative of Canute's reign is virtually non-existent. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle in its modern print edition, Canute gets like barely 2 pages, most of which are footnotes explaining that the great lacunae in his story. So it made more sense to flip it at that stage and talk about Canute's henchman, Godwin, who is after all in England when Canute is flitting around Scandinavia and the rest of Europe. People kind of say, oh, well, you know, he obviously focused on Offa because that's what other people have done. But you realize actually when you try different versions, you try to make it play in different ways. And sometimes you get a pat on the head and people say, this is an original way to do it. I wouldn't have focused it all on Wilfred, but fair play, plays really well. And other times they say, yawn, yawn, another chapter on King Alfred. And it's like, well, you try and write the late 9th century. Alfred is going to keep sticking his oar in, you know, he's going to keep cropping up. So there were reams and reams with this book that ended up being cut. There was a lot in chapter 1 there was a lot in chapter two as well, because chapter two had basically the emergence of kingdoms and the rich, very rich source in Bede's ecclesiastical history. People with limited knowledge of this period might assume that as you progress chronologically through it, the source material improves and thickens. And it's not the case, because it goes up and down, and largely because we've got Bede. So Bede gives us a portrait of the 7th century, which is far richer than anything we get to until we reach the 11th. And we can see the rulers and the churchmen and the churchwomen of the 7th century in far greater clarity and vivid colour than we can for most of the later periods. That means that you kind of gorge on Bede. And I wrote large kind of treatments of people like Ethelbert of Kent, Radwald and Edwin and those guys, crammed with anecdote from Bede. And my editor, who was very, very good and very robust, said, this is all kind of interesting. I mean, I'm paraphrasing. She didn't say this, but she said, it's all kind of interesting, brackets, but I am losing the will to live, you know? And and you do have that sense of you have to pull focus. So there was a lot of material cut from chapters like that. I can think of really tedious, specific examples. It wasn't like there was a whole chapter on some missing king I've left out.
Arthur.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. For example, yeah. Yeah. So it was sections cut within chapters rather than whole things being recast. I do have a plan to start with, you know.
Well, I mean, this is why I've been asking a lot of questions about things like structure, because I think there are a lot of people who are listening that want to write their own, or they're doing their own scholarship. They don't know how to structure it. And I think that you've taken on such a big project with such, like you say, a cast of thousands. So structure is important. Okay. But for the people who are listening for content, who are some of your favorite characters that you've built this around? I have to say the chapter on St. Wilfrid is one of my favorites in this book. He's amazing.
I think that's probably because I felt the same. You don't have to like them, of course. I mean, you don't have to like. No. I obviously didn't like Wilfrid very much. It's sort of a grudging admiration for his achievement, in inverted commas. But it's an achievement that kind of, whilst it advances his agenda, also kind of destroys the lives of countless others, sometimes literally. It's when they kind of speak to you across the centuries, you know, to sort of wax poetic for a second. It's that you suddenly can think, yeah, this feels like a real person. I can really get my teeth into this, and this will work really well. I mean, I probably shouldn't say this, because other people who've read it said, oh, I really enjoyed the Alfred chapter, but I came to Alfred with such baggage and such existing knowledge of Alfred. I was kind of thinking, oh, how do I do this with any sense of originality? Because there are perfectly good biographies out there of Alfred, existing ones. How can I do this and ring the changes? I mean, I struggled enormously to try and think of an inn for the Alfred chapter, until I stumbled across the fact that the oldest monument to Alfred, at least in Wessex, is a pub. You know, you might think it was a statue or a grammar school or something like that, but no, it's actually a pub where he was born in Wantage, the Alfred's Head. So Wilfrid was one of my favourites. The other one was Dunstan, because I think sometimes churchmen can be a turnoff. I mean, I speak as someone who, I think it's fair to say, throughout my career as a historian, I have preferred lay people to churchmen, church people, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't have to be the case, but you can kind of get the sense of, oh, well, this is for people who are into churchy things. This is for people who are themselves Christian. So to come across characters like Dunstan Athelwold, who are the very opposite of what you might think of today as good Christian types, especially in the case of Athelwold, they're fanatics. I mean, Athelwold comes across as nothing more than a kind of, everything has to be the same, everything has to be uniform. I caught you doing something I disagree with, so I think you should plunge your hand into a boiling cauldron just to show how contrite you are. You know, this is the kind of stuff you don't associate with the kind of polite, happy, all-embracing Christianity I was raised in 20th century Britain. It's a kind of Christianity that's read in tooth and claw, taking no prisoners. So when you read the source material and think, either because I've nodded and haven't appreciated this in the scholarship, or because I haven't seen anything that conveys to me the excitement of this story. And that feels great as a writer, because you're not approaching it with a kind of, oh, this feels so repetitive and jaded. It actually feels fresh and new. And you can actually get quite excited about sort of, let me share with you what I've discovered, you know? So that brings a sort of a joy to the writing process.
Then you're the guy in the pub who's saying, let me tell you something.
Yeah, except I'm hoping to be the guy in the pub that says, let me tell you a tale, and actually making you want to stay to the end rather than the guy who says, I'll tell you another thing about Dunstan. He was really good at embroidery, you know.
It's a good fact to know.
It's a good fact, but it doesn't make you kind of go, tell me more, you know.
No, I think that you've done amazing work with this book because it is such a delicate dance when you have not that much source material. You have so many characters that are you get to know and then they die and then you might not hear anything about them. So I think that you've really structured this in a way that works extremely well. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
What are you going to do now? You've gone from centuries where you had more source material to centuries where you had very little source material. What's next for you?
Well, increasingly, I joked earlier about kind of writing a, you know, you can't write a book about a Suffolk vicar in the 15th century who does not much. But I have tried to interest publishers in recent years in kind of one of these more like a side project, you know, where you can say, this is incredibly rich and interesting. You've never heard of this, of course, but I think this would be really a really great little pet project. And I haven't been able to attract the kind of funding that I need to fund my exorbitant independent historian's lifestyle. So it will probably be something that's a more sizable slice of history. And that probably means going later this time. And you mentioned Dan Jones earlier. And of course, that's a field, late Middle Ages, which is more heavily populated with successful popular historians. I mean, Helen Castor, Ian Mortimer, just two off the top of my head over a galaxy of talented individuals. So you couldn't just say the Wars of the Roses. You know, it would have to be clever. I'm going to have to triangulate in order to come up with something good. But I don't know.
What would bring you to a project like that? Do you think it would be, again, a story, a person?
I think actually the thing to do in that particular case is probably just to kind of, I mean, here's the difficulty. What you want to do is read as widely as possible and kind of actually say, this is the theme that would draw it all together. The main thing that strikes me is the contrast between the late Middle Ages and the high Middle Ages, which I've done in the past, is between, say, at least the 10th century and the early 14th century, the population is expanding, which means that land is becoming scarcer and the economy is growing and people are pushing to the margins. And that dynamic underpins the expansion of England into the rest of the British Isles, which is something that I chart, particularly in The Great and Terrible King, the whole kind of Rhys Davies, Robin Frame shtick. And that, of course, collapses when you get plagues in the 14th century, not just the Black Death, but pretty bad plagues in the second decade of the 14th century. And that sense of English kind of culture and political culture in retreat in the 14th century is something that I find quite interesting, sort of collapse, which maybe there's a theme in there. I don't know. But you want the license to read and explore and see if you can come up with something. And your publishers, of course, want you to have a big idea to begin with. This is the essential problem. And what you don't want to do is say, I'm going to write a book about this person and it's going to be brilliant. Yeah. And then get 6 months into the project and go, actually, this person is not really very interesting. And the source material is pretty rubbish.
Yeah.
So not painting yourself into a corner is important.
That is the pitfalls of our profession.
Yeah, that's my top tip for aspiring writers is don't take $500,000 to write a biography of Anne Boleyn or something, because it just because actually do take $500,000. Take the money and run.
Oh, absolutely.
Take the money and run. Yeah.
If you get $500,000, it's going to be to write about Anne Boleyn, of course. Well, whatever you write next, I'm going to be looking forward to it because I appreciate the way you write, your diligence and your sense of humor, which I think has come across both in the book and today. So congratulations on the book. I'm really happy to see it having a lot of success. Well done.
Thank you very much for having me on once again.
To find out more about Mark's work, you can follow him on Twitter at longshanks1307. His new book is The Anglo-Saxons, A History of the Beginnings of England, 400 to 1066. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. Hey, Peter, it's been a while.
Yeah, yes, welcome back. Welcome back to the world of trucks and cars and
thanks.
Buildings and all that.
Thank you. It's good to be back, but I missed the lake already.
We've had a good month. We were both at Leeds in a way.
Yes, we are virtually at Leeds at the beginning of July. Can't believe we're already near the end of July. But yeah, Leeds was great. I had a good time. I mean, there are still a lot of lectures that I still need to watch because if you were a member of the Leeds delegation, if you went to the conference, we have access to that until the end of August. So there's still a whole bunch of papers that I have to listen to.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know. There was so much, especially like I love medieval military history. So there's like a ton of stuff. So I still have to get through them all and maybe get some people to write for us. So.
Watch out, people. Peter is going to ask you to write. Yeah, I saw a lot of good papers, like I was saying. I like the ones that are, well, I was watching ones about monks now because that is my pet interest for a little while. And the ones about women's history, especially their roles as leaders, as queens. And yeah, I love listening to new scholarship. And I feel like there are a lot of good PhD candidates that are coming up through the ranks. And it's just so inspiring to see.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was a really good theme this year, kind of talking about climate and weather, things like that. So there's a lot of interesting papers around that. So yeah, fun.
Yeah, I mean, when you have a theme like that, you can get at it in all sorts of different ways, from an archaeological perspective, a geological perspective, from a literary perspective. It's very cool. It was a good time. And yeah, so for all the people who were at the conference, you still have another month to watch those videos. And Peter, you and I did one that got recorded as well.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking about like how medievalists can earn a living outside of academia, yeah, because apparently we're experts on it, so...
Well, I don't know that the pool is very big right now of people who are making a living at medieval studies, but we're hoping that it'll get bigger. And this is kind of our contribution to that by explaining all of the different ways that we are making enough to make this a full-time job.
Indeed, indeed. And I was really happy we had a really good turnout. So people asking interesting questions. So I say, yeah, my big advice is get on TikTok.
That is your big advice, yes.
Become TikTok famous as a medievalist.
So are you TikTok famous then?
No, I'm not.
Yes. So when Peter and I were coming up with this workshop, people, I was like, Peter, we ought to stick to the things that we are actually doing, not the things that, you know, we could be doing.
You can see my face on TikTok. You search hard enough. I look terrible though. That's the thing.
Oh, but you're there with confidence, which is really what's most important. So for the people who do want to see that video and they are members of the conference, they went to Leeds virtually, you can see that to the end of August. The question period was not recorded. So if you do have questions about what we talked about, of course, always feel free to get in contact with us anytime.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, there's still like an hour's worth of footage so that you can watch. It's pretty good.
Yeah, pretty good. Okay, what's going on the website this week?
Oh, there's a piece this week that I actually wrote, kind of a travel guide to 15th century Aegean. An Italian traveler, kind of like Italian priest, is kind of visiting all the islands. He gets into various adventures with shipwrecks and pirates, but he really loves all these islands like Rhodes and Crete and stuff like that. So it's just a wonderful kind of piece and beautiful images, and it's just a bunch of manuscripts, and they all have like details of all these islands. So check that out. Also, dietary advice for a Frankish king from the 6th century. So we have that. And there's little bits of news here and there. I've got something in the pipe that hopefully I'll let you know next week.
Yes. And there are a whole bunch of new movies coming out. So for the people who are in love with medieval studies, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is coming out really soon this week. Is it July?
July 31st here in North America. I just heard that it's been delayed a couple weeks in the United Kingdom. So check out our social media for some stuff on that.
Yes, absolutely. Stay safe, UK. And don't worry, Gawain will be there when you are safer. And then for everyone else who's interested in medieval movies, The Last Duel is coming out in the fall. It's coming out in October, I believe. And the trailer has already dropped for that. We're going to have some stuff on medievalist.net. Well, Peter's going to have stuff on medievalist.net. I'm going to have stuff on the podcast getting closer to that date as well. So there's lots going on right now. It's exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Very. Oh, cool. It's nice summertime news.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of awesome stuff, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from movies to magic, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, all over social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even pre-order the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which comes out in October. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.